dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have been privileged over the years to tap the intelligence which exists in abundance in Dr. Harold Rode. He is the former sort of duty expert of the United States Pentagon on so many matters involving the Middle East, particularly Turkey and Iran. He is these days a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, the author of numerous books and countless periodical pieces, including a personal favorite of mine, which is his publication for the Center for Security Policy Press entitled Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Harold Rode, it's so good to have you, and thank you for giving us an hour of your time to talk about, the myriad topics that are at the moment very much on our minds as a result of what's happening in your portfolio. I can't think of a better person to talk to about it. Glad to be able to do so with you. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's always a joy to talk with you, Frank.
Thank you. Let me talk to you first about Syria, Harold. We, of course, in recent days, have seen the President of the United States making several important policy pronouncements about that long-suffering country. First and foremost, of course, was the decision to get out of the way of an announced Turkish invasion of parts of that country. Just give us a quick sense of your take on that decision and the things that have flowed from it in the past few days. And we'll talk specifically about the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in a moment.
Well, typical of the Middle East, one day you're on top, the next day you're down below. And that we'll get to a little later on the Turkish side here. The Syrian Kurds have been our allies. They've been tried and tested. They've been our strategic allies for God knows how long. On the surface, it was terrible what happened. We retreat. We withdraw. Our military people there were extremely unhappy that we did that. 3 days of fighting, the Kurds suffered. And then President Trump comes in and basically comes up with a solution that he forces on the Turks and basically says good things about the Kurds. And he also says nice things about Erdogan and then adds, but if he gets out of line, we are going to destroy his economy and a few other things. Typical Trump and typical, it's sad for the Kurds, but on the other hand, Mazlum is their general. President Trump has been talking about how General Mazlum, he runs the Syrian Kurdish operation, has basically, he basically supports what we're doing now.
Yeah. Harold, let me just ask you to drill down on something you said there a moment ago. The popular public and certainly media treatment of what happened in the negotiations with Erdogan conducted by Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo after the president decided to remove U.S. forces from some of the areas the Turks were going to invade was that the Turks basically got what they wanted. Now, you've described that as his team forced on the Turks this sort of ceasefire, temporary ceasefire. Could you just try to help us think through what was the true character of those talks and their outcome?
Well, Frank, you and I were involved in the Pentagon negotiations for many, many years, and we know that what is said in the press and what happens behind the scenes are many times not the same. What I want to say imagine because I can't know, but I watched the change in Erdogan, so I assume. You know, is that President Trump announced what he did, and then immediately Vice President Pence and the Secretary of State Pompeo went to Turkey, and it appears to me from Erdogan's reaction that they read him the Riot Act. They said, look, you go in and you kill these people, we're going to destroy you. We're strangling your economy. Turkey's economy is in shambles. The only way it really survives is Qatar, which is their ally. Qatar gives them money from time to time. Qatar just, again, it's news. I don't really have any way of checking it out. It's supposedly just giving Turkey $15 billion to let's call it as a bridge gift. The Emir of Qatar also gave Erdogan a present of, I think it was a souped-up car, unbelievably expensive, like $100,000 or something like this. You and I would like to get gifts like that, but that's the Middle East.
Yeah. But Harold, that raises the question is, I've talked with one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, David Goldman, about what were the effects of the sanctions that the president imposed on Turkey after he was displeased with its immediate, you know, invasion. And he said that the Qataris, and perhaps the Chinese too, were basically blunting the effect of those sanctions by these kinds of gifts, not so much the car, I guess, but the the cash infusions, and such that there was barely a ripple in the Turkish economy and currency, particularly in contrast to what happened, you know, when the president imposed similar sanctions in connection with Pastor Brunson's extraction from a Turkish jail. Your thoughts?
Well, look, I'm no expert on economics, and David Goldman is certainly much better than I. Having said that, I think Erdogan and the people around him understand that they were given heroin. It makes them feel good. That's what the infusion of $15 billion is. But President Trump always has the option of making the sanctions worse and worse, tighter and tighter, and that means that people will be put out of work in Turkey. So what are they going to have, little stalls in the streets handing out money to people? It doesn't work. Sooner or later, the Turks know it. Their economy is in dire shape.
Yeah. Harold, I know that your bottom line on this is that given the fractious nature of the Middle East and the dog-eat-dog character of it, the president's right to have been set on extracting our forces from the region. You also mentioned the reaction of a number of our troops on the ground in Syria and the importance of the Kurds historically to our efforts in the region. Could you just net this out for us? Have we not only wound up in the midst of all of this, abandoning a key ally, as some have said, and put perhaps our reliability as a partner with others in the region and beyond at risk as well? Actually, Harold, I have to ask you to hold that thought. That's a question that will hang for a moment. We're going to come back and continue this very important conversation with Dr. Harold Rode, the former desk officer for Turkey in the U.S. Department of Defense, a longtime member of the senior staff of the Pentagon's extraordinary Office of Net Assessment under Dr. Andrew Marshall, and these days a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Harold Rode is our guest. We're talking with him about the various developments that have flowed from the decision by President Trump to extract American forces from the harm's way, shall we say, in Syria. Harold, I was just asking you the question of sort of netting out the upshot of all of this, the policy of reducing our footprint there being something that I think you generally support, and the consequences of doing so perhaps at the expense of allies, the Kurds, and specifically their case, as well as perhaps beyond.
Well, I think we have to distinguish between tactical and strategic allies. Tactical means that for today, we have something in common. And tomorrow, everything's up in the air. That, frankly, has been our relationship with Turkey, especially under Prime Minister or now President Erdogan. He's a Muslim fundamentalist, the Muslim Brotherhood, and he, along with Qatar and other places in the Middle East, and they bear us, they don't like us, is the bottom line. I'm being highly understated when I say that. Okay, now, let's look at, there's a phrase in Arabic, which I think summarizes it for everybody. It's a day of onions, a day of honey, a day of onions, meaning one day we're close buddies like honey, the next day, onions, we're ready to kill each other. That is not the case with the Kurds. Through thick and thin, through the Iraq war, through the Kuwait war before that, and when we were having problems with Saddam Hussein, the Kurds have always been on our side. Their strategic interests and ours align. They see, a lot of them see Islam as Arab imperialism, so they have to worry about Arab imperialists. The Turks basically want to take them over and turn the Kurds into Turks, that is, to make them no longer identify as Kurds. Well, they've been Kurds for 3,000 years, so that's a little unlikely. And the only possible allies that they have in the area whose interests will align no matter what is always America and Israel. The others are temporary friends to the Kurds and to us.
At best. Yeah. But Harold, you know, this is so interesting because, again, there are a few people, I think, and certainly Washington circles that understand the Turks as well as you do. It's almost always the case that they are described as our strategic allies, not a, you know, comme ci, comme ça, as the French say, here today, gone tomorrow kind of tactical ally, as you've said, not notably reflecting the fact that they're members of NATO and therefore, you know, treaty partners to this country. What you've just said suggests that we've got this backwards, that the Turks are, well, you've actually contributed to a book that we published at the Center for Security Policy Press a few years ago called Turkey Ally No More. That puts a fine point on it, but certainly suggests that it's not a strategic ally. How do you, again, square those competing contentions?
Well, what is the Prime Minister, President Erdogan's long-term strategy here? Turkey used to be the center of the Sunni world. The Ottoman Sultan, who ruled from Istanbul for 653 years, was the caliph, the head of the Sunni world. What Erdogan is trying to do is reimpose not only the Ottoman Empire, that Turkey again be the center of the Muslim world, And then simply take the fight onwards. I'll tell you, from extensive travel in the Balkans and all sorts of former Ottoman areas and throughout Europe, which is in the areas especially where the Turks are, which is primarily in Germany, what you see is that Erdogan is pushing the idea of, again, Islam on the march. We Turks will take over and lead Islam. I mean, I've had people both in Germany and in Macedonia specifically, Muslims, tell me their leader is Erdogan, even though they don't even have Turkish passports. He's number one. Everybody else, and then they have some rather choice words, which we're not going to say on the radio, about everybody else. So they see Erdogan as, for the way Erdogan sees himself, he wants to, Istanbul should be the capital of the Muslim world, of the Sunni Muslim world, and eventually it will take over the Shiites as well. How this is in America's interest is beyond me.
Right, me too. I got to say, the millions of Turks in Germany is a particular problem to the extent that they are resonating to the leadership of Erdogan in the heart of Europe, to say nothing of, you know, the Balkans and of course, the Middle East as well. And Harold, this raises the question to my way of thinking, you know, is the president, when he is saying nice things about Erdogan, as you mentioned earlier, is he, as you see it, clear-eyed about the inherent problems with Erdogan and his ambitions? He seems to be intent on inviting him to the White House. He has certainly chatted with him and as best I can tell, holds him in high regard. What would your advice to the president be about the reliability of Erdogan as a partner, ally.
My advice would be he's not. And all I can say is, in order to try to understand President Trump's strategy, it really looks to me like his book, The Art of the Deal. You want to keep your enemy off balance. On one hand, he'll say publicly nice things about Erdogan, but I have no doubt that the visit of the vice president and Secretary Pompeo basically led him to the riot act. Why is that? Erdogan supports ISIS. And there's no question, at the very least, what he's looked the other way as people came in and out of Turkey for ISIS. It was a sieve.
But Harold, I'm sorry, just to explore that for a moment. Is that really the case? Or does nothing happen in Turkey that would be without his acquiescence? So there's a more direct role in this business of safe haven and funding and, you know, transit and the like through Turkey for these ISIS operatives. And therefore, that it may be quite, shall we say, imprudent to rely on Turkey to keep a lid on ISIS in Syria now. No?
Yeah, what is that like, having wolves guard the sheep?
The hen house, I think, is the term, yes.
Pen house, yeah, thank you. That's what I can only tell you. I've had one personal experience with Erdogan, and he did not know that he was standing next to a Turkish speaker. And to show you how he looks at the world, he had just given a political speech. Someone wanted to introduce me to Erdogan. And I very politely stood beside him. And all of a sudden, at this political speech, he's having an argument about business deals with some of his advisors. And he gets extreme. He's a very emotional person. And he got mad and he yelled about this, apparently, his opponent in this business deal. He called him Alevi Tupek. Alevi is a non-Sunni, let's call it religious minority, closer to Shiites in Turkey. Köpek means dog. And as we heard the president very, and I totally support him having called al-Baghdadi in Syria a dog is the worst thing you can call somebody in the Middle East. I can tell you, in among the Arabs, to call someone kalb, which is the Arabic for dog, is grounds for a fight and worse.
I'm pretty sure it was not an accident, the choice of those words by the president, right?
It was beautiful what the president said. Absolutely beautiful. Now, this is Erdogan. How we could, from the very beginning, and a lot of people in Washington, even when he was mayor of Istanbul, before he was prime minister and then president, and I think really dictator, they're trying to find what we call moderate Islam. They're trying to impose our culture. We always look for moderates. I hereby dub thee Sir Moderate. It means I can deal with you. You speak the holy language, that's English. And you look at me in the face as we do when we talk. If we say something which isn't 100% true, our eyes look away something. Erdogan is quite capable of looking you straight in the face and lying to you. And his translators, of course, will soften what he has to say. Again, I have witnessed what he has said in Turkish and how the translators, shall we say, moderate it to make us feel more happy, content with what he's saying. When he's saying things that if they would really.
Yeah. So, Harold, when you hear the president inviting him to the White House, when you hear the nice things that he's saying about him, if this is a good cop, bad cop routine, and the vice president and secretary of state, you know, hammered him in private, what is the likelihood that we're going to see him behaving going forward, whether it's with respect to ISIS, whether it's respect to Syria, whether it's respect to, heavens knows, our own presence in Turkey, which has been a sometime thing under Erdogan, as you've indicated, surrounding Incirlik air base at one point and cutting off the power to our forces there, for heaven's sakes.
Yes. Look, all I can say is, again, from personal experiences, without going into details, when I worked at the Pentagon, there were a few things that happened. He promised X, Y, and Z. We supposedly we're going to be able to use Turkish territory and Turkish forces when we invaded Iraq. And it lost by 3 votes in the parliament, and Erdogan apologized. And some of our very senior people blamed the military in Turkey on that, which is exactly what Erdogan wanted to do. Erdogan could get anything he wanted passed in parliament. This was a way on the surface of saying one thing and behind the scenes doing another.
Duplicitousness and unreliability, I guess, are the key point. Harold, we have to pause for just a second. We'll be back with more in this hour-long, very special interview with Dr. Harold Rode, one of our country's most informed and deeply thoughtful analysts of what is afoot in the Middle East. We'll be right back with more right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Harold Rode about what is afoot in the Middle East in the aftermath of some rather dramatic developments, relocation of U.S. forces, Turkish invasion of Syria, the assassination of Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the ISIS leader. These have set off, of course, or are further exacerbating, it might be a better way to say it, some of the dynamic trends in the Middle East more broadly. And I want to explore those with one of our country's preeminent experts on the subject, Harold Rode, now with the Gatestone Institute as a distinguished senior fellow for many years with the Department of Defense, the author of Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Harold, you are, in addition to being an extraordinary resource on Turkey, about which we've been discussing a lot to this point, I want to pivot to one of your other areas of expertise, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran. They are very much interested parties in what's been developing in Syria, of course, but they have other regional ambitions extending up to the Mediterranean through Lebanon and, you know, the other way, Iraq, and of course, Yemen. Talk about the latest developments in the region, including the cumulative effect of President Trump's sanctions policies towards Iran, for what the Turks are able to do now and are doing in the region.
Well, Iran, Turkey represent a battle between Shiites and Sunnis. If you look at all that has gone on in the past 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, what you see is that Iran has taken some huge losses. We'll get in the end to how we could expect them to react. How were these losses? They have been working to set up a corridor between Iran, a land corridor, all the way to the Mediterranean. They basically, behind the scenes, have run the Iraqi government, and everybody in Iraq will tell you the Iranians run it. In Lebanon, even though there's a formal government, it's Hezbollah, which is an Iranian fifth column. It's an Iranian military arm in Lebanon. The Lebanese government shows that it was controlled by Hezbollah. In both countries, you have serious riots against Iran. In Iraq, we said we don't care about all of this, you know, this ideology stuff. We have no bread. You guys in government are stealing us blind. And the government is now shooting. They're shooting Shiites. Now, the Shiite Vatican, let's say, it's the Shiite capital of the world. It's not Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. It is Najaf and Karbala. There are two cities in Iraq. And these are the Shiite places where you go to make pilgrimages. They're the center of the Shiite world, the Shiite senior religious leaders in Iraq, in the world, this is the place they make pilgrimages to. Now, the fact is that in those cities, which are Shiite and heavily controlled, basically, by Iran, You got Shiite revolts there against Iran. I could summarize this, and again, I'm going to clean up the phrase, what Arab Shiites think of Iran, which is a Shiite country. The Arabs say that if you break open the bone of a Persian, let's say SH, whatever letter T comes out, if that doesn't tell you what Arab Shiites think of Iranians, then nothing really does. So the Iranians very, very shrewdly, since before we invaded Iraq in 2003, have been trying to run the place, let's say, quietly. No, they failed. They failed, at least for the moment. In Lebanon, the same thing. You've got all sorts of, as they would call, ethnic religious groups, which is what identity is in the Middle East. It's not nationality. They're all working together against Hezbollah, against the government. You guys steal us blind. We need jobs. We want food. We go to bed hungry. And they blame this on Iran. In the Middle East, no one ever takes responsibility for anything. It's always someone else's fault, which is why you always hear blaming. Whatever it is, you did it to me. Now, so Iran is losing in Lebanon. It's losing in Iraq and in Syria. On the surface, since the Iranians have had a problem with the Kurds in the past, they have developed a very sophisticated way of keeping the Kurds, both in Iraq and Syria, under wraps so they don't make problems for the Iranian Kurds, which are right across the border, because all Kurds, they wanted their own state, basically. Now, what happened is when President Trump withdrew from the Kurdish area in Syria, what happened was that the Iranians all of a sudden had a problem because they were sure that ISIS is the Sunni group, and they see Shiites, which are, again, the Iranians, as apostates. And the punishment in Islam for apostasy is death. So the Iranians said, oh, my God, now we got a problem. And the Iranians, who have very, very limited resources, had to move troops up in the north to worry into the Iranian north on the Turkish border to make sure to try to keep things quiet. The Turks then moved troops in, and now you have Iranian and Turkish troops facing each other. That is something which is not good for Iran. If you see that Iran is collapsing in Lebanon and in Iraq, again, this could change overnight, but that's the way it appears. Like, I don't know how they're going to put this genie back in the bottle. Look at the other places where Iran is. And that is in Yemen, across the border in Saudi Arabia. And they tried to, it seems, get up to Jeddah on the Red Sea. What is Jeddah? It's 40 miles from Mecca. Mecca has no water. And an Iranian ship blew up in right outside of Jeddah, making a beeline to the desalination plant. If there would be no water, if that would have blown up, then Jeddah and Mecca would have no water. And it would show the rest of the Muslim world that the Saudi Sunnis can't provide security for Mecca and Medina. That's the Iranian goal. Now, there are two scenarios here, and it's very, very important. One is the traditional Iranian way is to retreat, regroup, wait for an opportunity, and pounce again. And then the other, and this is unique to this leadership of Iran, they believe that by provoking a conflagration, that their Messiah, the Mahdi, they call him, will come down, they'll make him come down, and save the Shiites.
Yeah. This is such an important point, Harold Rode, and I've learned much about this from you over the years. And thank you for that very comprehensive description of what's in play at the moment with Iran. But one cannot underestimate, it seems, the importance of ideology here to this regime and its commitment, I guess, theological commitment as well to this notion that the end times will be precipitated on the present leadership's watch, no less, and that it sounds an awful lot like the apocalypse, if that's going to eventuate. So actions like the attack by the Iranians on the Saudi oil facilities and this apparent aborted attack, fortunately, on the desalinization plant seem to be designed to really go for the throat of the Saudis in a way that might precipitate such an end-time scenario, no?
Yes, and if, shall we say, there would be strong American reaction against them, as the late, great Professor Bernard Lewis, greatest Middle East scholar of the late 20th century, used to say, a conflagration is an incentive, an inducement for this leadership in Iran. And interestingly, Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the one who brought this regime to power, he hated present rulers of Iran. He thought they were dangerous because he thought that they could bring down the whole operation. He tried to keep them away. Now they're in power.
Yes, and have been for some time. Harold, one of the things that I've learned from some of your analysis is that the Iranians or their proxies are actually now murdering their own people in the streets of Lebanon, in the streets of Iraq. And you described, you know, some of the hostilities that the Arab Shiites have for the Iranian ones. Where does this likely end? Despite, you know, some choices that the Iranian regime has to make, there are some choices that are being made by others as well. Do you anticipate that Hezbollah is actually going to be overthrown in terms of its control of Lebanon, and that similarly the Iranian-backed regime in Iraq will also similarly, you know, be displaced by people who are not in the pocket of the Iranian regime?
Well, I'm not a prophet, but I'd just like to say the following. It looks that way now. It could change in an instant. But here's the thing. In the Middle East, nothing is ever solved. There are no such thing as bygones be bygones. So if they put the genie back in the bottle, the Iranians, don't worry. Everybody else is still going to hate them. And these conflicts are, again, all Middle Eastern conflicts are unsolvable. When President Trump said these are tribes and nations, whatever they are, he called them, and they've been fighting for 100 years. You know what? President Trump underestimated, this is the opposite of an exaggeration. They have been fighting each other for so long, I would say at least since the advent of Islam, which is about 1,400 years ago. These are never-ending conflicts. Anybody who predicts is, you can't know. This is the Middle East. One day you're up, one day you're down.
Okay. Well, Harold, we have to take one final break. We'll talk with you more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final segment of our very, very timely conversation with Dr. Harold Rode, one of our country's leading experts on the Middle East, about, well, what, given all we've just discussed, the nature of the conflict that has raged in the Middle East, basically since, as he said a moment ago, the advent of Islam, involving Shia and Sunni, involving various tribes and now nation states. Harold, you have described favorably, I think, the president's desire not to be further embroiled in these conflicts. And yet, I think you understand at least as well as anybody else the degree to which an American presence in the region is important to how other powers calculate their options, some of which may be very much at odds with our interests. I'm interested particularly in your thoughts on the role that the United States should be playing, and specifically how that relates to or might be affected by what the Russians are doing in the region, in part filling vacuums of power created by us.
Well, again, to quote the late Professor Bernard Lewis, go in, don't ever try to occupy the area. Go in, do what we did when the al-Baghdadi raid. Go in, take care of business. You are ruthless in making sure that you win and get out. The Middle East is the place that you cannot rule. It will rule you. It will suck you in. So I would argue we have to be able from time to time, let's call it like a booster shot, to remind them who's boss, and it's the United States of America, which is by far the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. The United States has to go in when somebody is doing something we don't, do something militarily like we did with al-Baghdadi. I would argue we could do the same with the Iranian military, not the Iranian people, God forbid, and take care of it. Now,
particularly people like Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
I'm sure that the Iranian leadership is extremely, extremely afraid, petrified. Obviously, they read Trump wrong. They think they had him in their back pocket because they have all these, let's call it, Iranian government lobby people in Washington telling them all sorts of things. And here you see President Trump, boom, goes out and does what they, if we have the ability to find Soleimani, we look. Clearly, the left knows a lot. Look at what the Israelis managed to do in conquering the entire Iranian nuclear archive. Clearly, we have in the West a way of doing this. And the Americans and the Israelis are like one package. They work together beautifully. All I'm arguing for is I think it'd be great to take out Soleimani, just as you said, Frank, 100%.
So, Harold, talk a little bit about the Russian role there. They are more of an occupying force, I would argue, than we are at the moment, certainly in Syria. But they seem to have – clearly Putin was traveling all over the region, ambitions to be a much bigger player there. Should that trouble us? What should we do about it if it does?
I think we have to understand other people as they understand themselves and develop policy from that. Here's the thing the Russians have to face, and here's why Syria is important to them. The overwhelming majority of former Soviet Muslims are Sunni. Any Sunni victory, ISIS or whatever, hurts the Soviet, will influence the Soviet Muslims. It will give them like a shot in the arm, a shot of testosterone, whatever. And the Russians have, it's probably up to about 33% of Moscow is legally and illegally resident former Soviet Muslims. It's a very serious problem for Moscow. Now, Syria has been basically a Sunni hold, and it's been run by the Sunnis. Excuse me, the largest group are Arab Sunnis. The rulers are not, they're Alawis, and they hate the Sunnis.
And vice versa.
Yes, of course. But in that, the Russians and the Alawis have something in common. They both hate the Sunnis. Now, that's number one. Now, in Syria, there's actually a war going on between the Russians and the Iranians. The Russians, actually, Assad is a Russian puppet more than an Iranian puppet. And I think it our job is to encourage these differences.
Calls to mind Henry Kissinger's old story about hoping they both lose, right? And seeing if we can arrange that.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, let them all fight. And our job should be to only worrying about what is most important to us, to go in, get the job done like we did with al-Baghdadi. I cannot overemphasize this. And get out.
Yeah. Let me just turn back to Turkey for a moment, because I think it's tremendously important that we get your counsel on what our policy towards the Turks should be. It sounds as though you're appreciative of and supportive of President Trump's unpredictability and okay with him saying nice things about Erdogan as long as he's also whacking him with some regularity to keep him in line. Is that basically your prescription for where we should be going at the moment with respect to the Turks? And to what degree do things like the passage in the House of Representatives yesterday of this Armenian genocide resolution, which is adamantly opposed by the Turks, play into such a strategy?
Well, all that I want to say helps. Now, in the Middle East, the most important thing is honor. And the Turkish people believe that, or Turks believe in general, that there was no Armenian genocide. I would argue that what they did to the Armenians was second-degree murder, meaning it was not at all planned. But they tried to get, in classic Middle Eastern fashion, the Armenians, a certain section of the Armenians was helping the Russians. This is World War I, and even before. So they tried to move Armenians out of the border. Turkey is an unbelievably organized country until someone throws a tiny monkey wrench into it, and then there's total chaos. So they moved the Armenians out of the border area with Russia. There was no planning, no whatever, and a lot of awful things happened. And locals looked at it as an opportunity to steal the stuff that the Armenians left in their places. And they stole the women and children and forced them to become Muslims. There are a lot of people in eastern Turkey today who have Armenian origins who, in these things, were forced to become Muslims. They didn't want to be. Now, that's all true. Is it a genocide like the Holocaust? No, because that was all planned. We know this, the Wannsee Conference. And Hitler himself said that whatever he does to the Jews doesn't really, you know, the world won't give a damn, because it didn't give a damn what happened to the Armenians. There is no question that a lot of Turks and Kurds in eastern Turkey also died. But the fact of the matter is that the Turks, unintentionally in the beginning, were horrible to the Iranians. In the 19th century, in Turkey, the Armenians were called the faithful, in Ottoman Turkish, the faithful nation. They ran the mint. The government had to put their mint in the arms of the Armenians. But all this is nice history. What matters here is that it makes the Turks livid.
And Harold, let me just ask you quickly, because we are just about out of time. What should we be doing about Turkey's membership in NATO, which is usually cited as the reason why we can't really do very much about Turkey?
Well, here's what I would do from a Turkish point of view. I would talk about NATO and talk about different NATO members and leave Turkey out in conversation. That would scare the Turks. The only thing that we need Turkey for is that the Straits, Istanbul, Bosphorus, and the Marmara Sea, that's the only way the Russians have a warm water port out into the world in the winter months. That is not going to change. But we surely can make life difficult for the Turks if they try and work with the Russians on this.
And we've seen certainly Donald Trump doing that. Harold Rode, the time flies by when we have a chance to visit with you. You've given us much food for thought about the complex character of the Middle East and how some of the recent developments are really making both the challenges that we've long confronted there more serious, I would argue, and some of the opportunities that are present as well, in part as a result of Donald Trump's policies, more interesting. This is what we need your help with. We will look forward to furthering our conversations with you and the insights that you provide. Harold Rode, in the meantime, keep up the great work you do at the Gatestone Institute and with us, of course, at the Center for Security Policy from time to time. Thank you so much for sharing so much of your time today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.